The drought of recent years has forced us to think anew about water sources and uses and wonder where we end up if we keep going the same way. The same kind of wondering goes on in other parts of the country, including in the Great Plains, spanning the middle of the country. The plains are home to the great Ogallala Aquifer, the groundwater source for several states. The plains are also where today's guest comes from and where she returns in her memoir, The Ogallala Road, a story of love, family, and the fight to keep the Great Plains from running dry. Julene Baer graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. Her essays have appeared in several anthologies and in the New York Times and Chicago Tribune. The Ogallala Road is her second book, available in paperback just this week. Julene, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's great to be here.
So set things up for us. You grew up on the farm but moved far away from it?
Yes. Like many farm children, I thought Kansas was boring. And when I was 18 years old, I left and went to San Francisco and thought what I thought was going to be a much more exciting life out there. But after a few years, I began to realize that that really wasn't me. And so I began to return to my roots, at least in my mind, not necessarily physically, until my mid-30s when I went back for a short while and farmed with my father.
How many generations back in the family did farming the plains go?
Well, for my family, my grandfather had pioneered there in the late 1800s. But his father had pioneered nearby in Nebraska, so I guess that makes it four.
Wow, that's a long long stretch of time for mm-hmm. the family on the farm. There's a number of wonderful passages in here, and this is an early one that says, "Our sense of beauty is a survival instinct, telling us that a place can sustain us for generations to come." In the first pages, were you seeing places that once were beautiful and were no longer?
That's right. In the beginning of the book, I go back out to the original farm that I grew up on. By then, my family had traded that land for some other land in the county, and I discovered that the house was gone, and the farmstead was gone, and it had been replaced by a center pivot irrigation sprinkler. Those sprinklers irrigate a quarter section, 130 acres. The corners are left dry land, but the center is all irrigated. And so the original farmstead was gone, and also the creek that I used to follow out into the pasture, which was just a dry creek in my childhood, had once been beautiful. It had this clear, beautiful sand. It was just this open creek bed with this beautiful sand in it, and I would find arrowheads in that creek bed. And that had been silted in by all the newly farmed pasture land around it.
So the other pastures nearby had their stuff and ended up in that creek bed?
Right. Almost all of the pasture land in western Kansas by the time I return, and this is in the beginning of 2000, the 2000s, it was 2001, almost all of that pasture land had been farmed. And a lot of the reason for that was the pressure of irrigation. It was much more lucrative to grow those irrigated crops than to graze cattle or sheep.
So were people pulling more water out of the aquifer as time went on?
Yes, gradually more and more. We started irrigating in the late 1960s on our farm. And so in that time, we've used up 30% of the water in Kansas. And this, of course, extends into these other states as well. But in Kansas, it's been 30% so far, and they predict that if we keep going at this rate, we will use up another 40% in the next 50 years.
So we're talking about potentially pumping out this huge aquifer.
Right. Now, it's not an underground lake, like some people like to refer to it.
Right.
Really, it's saturated sands and gravels, so the amount of water in different areas varies depending on what they call the saturated thickness. So in our particular area, that's what we're facing. And there are farmers in that area that live in areas where they just didn't have very much saturated thickness to begin with, and they're already out of water.
For the people who don't know the Ogallala Aquifer, I mean, it's one of those things you hear about sort of peripherally if you don't live in that part of the country. Give us a sense, Julene, of size and importance.
Well, it extends from southern South Dakota all the way to North Texas. It underlies 174,000 square miles of farmland. That's larger than California. Its importance is as a world grain producer. We provide a lot of the grain for the entire world. And what we're looking at now with climate change is that if we continue, if it continues to get hotter and we have longer periods of drought, then we're going to need that aquifer just to sustain the crops that traditionally we were able to grow without the aid of irrigation.
And you show some, I actually looked at some maps based on the things you said in the book. So in your lifetime alone, how has the map of the Ogallala Aquifer changed?
Well, when you look at the maps of depletion, you see these areas that are bright red or dark brown, depending on the map, indicating that the water is either gone or almost gone. And those areas are spreading, sort of like cancers spread throughout a human body.
It's not a pretty thing to look at on a map. The Ogallala Road, a story of love, family, and the fight to keep the Great Plains from running dry, is Julene Bear's memoir, now out in paperback. We'll come back and talk more with Julene and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Julene Bear and you in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Reinley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the writer Julene Bear. Her memoir, her second book, is called The Ogallala Road, a story of love, family, and the fight to keep the Great Plains from running dry. And if you've got the reference in The Ogallala Road, you realize that Julene grew up above the Ogallala Aquifer right through the middle of the country, a very critical bit of groundwater aquifer. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about her life above it and her return to it. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to be clear here, because in our part of the country, people generally irrigate because they have to, because no water falls during the growing season. So, I mean, is there a bit of slacking off in irrigation sometimes in the Great Plains because rain does fall?
Well, where I come from, we only got 17 inches a year, and only about 12 inches came during the growing season. So it's really a semi-arid region as well. Corn, which is the crop that is most profitable right now to grow there, and consequently we grow a lot of it, requires 14 inches of irrigation water every year, and the aquifer only recharges at the rate of less than an inch a year.
And how does it recharge? How does water get down into the aquifer?
It is from rainfall and those stream beds, the sandy beds of those stream beds. The water percolates down into the underlying aquifer.
And I must admit, when I first read the amount of water that people pump out of it, even just on your own family's farm, my eyes got really big.
200 million gallons a year out of 5 irrigation wells, and we weren't that large a farmer, really.
200 million gallons a year?
200 million gallons, right. As a matter of fact, on the plains, we pump 19 million acre-feet a year out of the aquifer, and only 12 million acre-feet a year flows down the Colorado River.
Ah, okay. So this should indicate a bit of a disparity right there in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Because the Colorado River serves 40 million people, there aren't that many farmers on the plains by comparison. But of course, it supports a whole industry, a whole agricultural industry.
So if we go back pre-settlement, what existed in the sections of the plains? Was this prairie grass, that sort of thing?
It was beautiful. It was buffalo grass prairie. And when I was growing up, buffalo grass is short grass, by the way, and we call it buffalo grass because it supported something like 40 million bison. One of the things that we're seeing on the plains is, as a consequence of irrigation, those streams that do run are no longer flowing. They're being dried out. I've seen springs dry up in the last 10 years because the water table is being drawn down below its ability to flow into the stream.
Do we have any idea how much lower the overall level is in the Ogallala Aquifer? Is it not consistent place to place? I mean, as some of the maps I saw indicated dropping by feet.
Right. In some years, these drought years we had, 2011, 2012, we would see drops of anywhere from 2 to 4 feet. And it's actually going down faster in this first 10 or 15 years of this century than it has gone down previously. So we're exceeding the rate. We're pulling the water out at a faster rate now.
So the general impression is certainly that we get, or used to get anyway, thus older folks, in elementary school was that the middle part of the country is a great place for growing grains. You know, you get all the corn, all the wheat you want to. This mm-hmm. is the nation's breadbasket and so forth. I get the sense that this is not necessarily the best place to have a breadbasket.
I think it is and was the breadbasket because of the perfect growing conditions for wheat. We don't need to irrigate in order to grow wheat there. Now, that might change with climate change, and there have been drought years when farmers who had irrigation wells were supplementing their wheat crops. But traditionally, we've been able to grow as much wheat as we wanted. It's just been great, a great wheat state. My father was very expert, as were all of his neighbors, at nurturing the moisture in his soil. He had all these techniques to do that. And so it was sort of a way of life, really. We built our lifestyles around the fact that it didn't rain that much.
And the number you cite is very close to what the average precipitation is for Medford, Oregon, just a few miles away from where we sit in any given year. Julian Baer's memoir is called The Ogallala Road, and we're taking some calls here on the Jefferson Exchange. Let's go to Steve and Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Howdy. They're talking about building a huge oil pipeline from Canada down to Houston or wherever. And if this thing has a leak, have you delved into, how much damage it could do to that?
Yes, I've looked into that. And it is important to understand that it isn't an underground body of water. It's saturated sands and gravels. So if there's a spill in the pipeline, it's not necessarily going to travel that far. However, it's going to be exceptionally harmful in that particular area, and it's most likely that the pipeline would break because these pipelines always do.
Can we guess then that you are not a big fan of the Keystone XL pipeline as currently proposed?
No, I'm not a big fan of the Keystone pipeline, certainly not just because of the damage that could be done to the Ogallala Aquifer in that region, but because of what it would do in terms of climate change in the future. We're burning too much fossil fuel as it is.
Well, our listeners are quite astute on things like the Ogallala Aquifer, it appears, and so we've actually got a few phone calls lined up for you. Here is Paul in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Julian Baer.
Good morning. Nothing pithy. A comment and two questions. Back at the turn of the 19th and 20th century in the Rogue Valley, corn was raised as a sub-irrigated crop. In other words, no irrigation was required. Came right out of the water table. Don't think you can do that anymore. The questions I have to do, first of all, with are you facing salination problems with the water you're pulling up out of the aquifer? Is it affecting your crops? And then secondly, has there been any fracking activity going on within the realm of the aquifer, and has it had any impact? And I'll take my answers off the air.
Great. Thanks, Paul.
Okay. I'm not really familiar with salination problems on the high plains. I think it might be happening as wells get drawn down to the very bottom, but I'm not aware of it being that much of a problem in that particular area. As far as fracking, yes, fracking is going on in the region, and it is damaging to the extent that poisonous water that gets pumped back up out of the aquifer or out of those wells needs to be put somewhere. And wherever you put it, you're going to endanger the aquifer. I understand that there's a waste dump that has been permitted in western Nebraska, and the Nebraskans in that area really fought that, but it has gone through.
This is a disposal well where they're just pumping this stuff back into the ground?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, which I was reading was the major cause of the seismic activity in Oklahoma as well.
Mm-hmm.
Another call here from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Julian Baer, the author of The Ogallala Road.
Hi. My question is, how deep are the wells back there in the Midwest? I'll give you an example. My well here in Grants Pass, it's about 120 feet. I get 30 gallons a minute. I had read a story that places like Minnesota or maybe even Florida, the water's property is very close to the surface. So anyway, that's what I want to know.
All right, thank
okay,
you.
These are pretty deep wells. They range from around 120 feet to around 300 feet.
Okay, so not tremendously deep wells. I mean, I was just reading something mm-hmm. this morning. There's a 100 years ago today in the newspaper feature in the Medford paper that points out that people were drilling wells 1,200 feet deep in the Rogue Valley 100 years ago. And not mm-hmm. finding very good water. So by comparison, it doesn't sound terribly deep.
It was really alarming to me to see the chart online. I was able to go online. We have an observation well mm-hmm. on our property, meaning the Kansas Geological Service checks it every year. And to discover that our well was right there for all to see, and it was dropping precipitously over time. That well had been drilled in 1949, the year I was born, so this water issue is very personal to me, and that's why I wrote a very personal book about it.
You really did. It's called The Ogallala Road, A Story of Love, Family, and the Fight to Keep the Great Plains from Running Dry. Obviously, with the title The Ogallala Road, there's a lot in here about the Ogallala Aquifer. Julene Baer is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, and you can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Your dad used to say, use it or lose it of the water from the aquifer. What did he mean by that?
Well, irrigation farmers were given a certain allocation. They could pump so much water each year, but under that policy, they had to keep pumping that much water. Otherwise, they would lose the permit or it would go down.
So conservation was not really encouraged in that sense.
Right. Now, that has changed somewhat. I don't think completely, but the governor of Kansas has managed to change the law so that use it or lose it is not nearly as much a factor as it used to be.
Let's talk about your own odyssey then. You talked about leaving the Midwest and ending up in San Francisco, for example. What brought you back to Kansas?
Well, I underwent a personal evolution out in California, and what happened was I started going camping in the High Sierras, and I dove into my first mountain lake, and I was transformed. I felt like I had been reborn back into nature after coming out of that lake, and I became this zealous water swimmer, or lake swimmer after that. But I also fell in love with the Mojave Desert in Southern California because I was from an arid place where you could see far and the air was clear and there weren't very many people. So I moved there to live alone in a little mountain cabin out in the middle of the wilderness. And a short time after that, I was riding pretty high, doing great, learning to do all the things that I thought only men could do in my childhood, like fix my own truck and build my own kitchen cabinet. Cabinets. I didn't have electricity, so I just did this with a saw. And then I met my downfall. He was a cowboy from that region, and it turned out he wasn't as good a marriage material as I thought he was. And next thing I knew, I was back on the farm, pregnant with my son, and became one of my father's flood men back in Kansas, meaning I would go out and change the sets on the irrigation pipes.
Mm-hmm. All right, so you got Jake out of that relationship.
I got Jake out of that relationship, so it wasn't all for naught.
No, not at all. You mentioned some factors in marrying young, like what?
Well, marrying young at 18. First of all, this was my second marriage, so mm-hmm. I can blame marrying young on the problems I had in the first marriage, which lasted 8 years. But I blame loneliness and isolation for the second marriage, which lasted only 8 months.
Okay. Then you meet very early in the book, The Ogallala Road, Ward. In fact, you meet him by the side of a creek that you're looking at on the old...
I do. I had gone out there to see if I could find any of the springs that the Native Americans had camped beside and which had made it possible for my own ancestors to settle in that region because they couldn't dig a well, obviously, in the time they needed water to drink while they did that. So I was out there looking for one of those springs. I found one of those springs. I was really excited because it meant that my family and our neighbors hadn't drained the surface of every last drop, at least. And I was sitting in the shade of a cottonwood tree, and down the hill came this pickup pulling a stock trailer. I recognized the sound, that familiar rattle.
Yeah.
And And out of his pickup stepped this man who, it turned out, had read my first book. Well, I thought that the only people who had read my first book in that area were my second grade teacher and my mother. So I was pretty excited to meet such a person there. And so a relationship evolved from that, and that forms the narrative, part of the narrative in the book, the story of that relationship.
Well, in fact, it moves fast enough that pretty soon you write, "He's from there. I'm kissing a man from there." What scared you about there, Julian?
Well, the fact that I had considered it such a backwater. I didn't think I could have a social life there. I had lived back there for a short while in my mid-30s, as I mentioned. And one of the reasons I left was because it was hard to make friends there as a single mother. And also, I was troubled by the environmental practices in the region, and I really didn't want to have any part of the farm and what we were doing.
So it sounds like Kansas was less of a fond homecoming than an obligation by the time you met Ward.
Exactly. At least I thought, but unconsciously, that place had made me. It had shaped me. It had made me who I am. And I think I really longed to have a community there like I had had in my childhood. And Ward had all these friends and had never really left for very long. And so it was this opportunity to live there and have a life with a like-minded person and also be reintegrated back into the place that is really, truly most meaningful to me.
We're talking to Julian Bear about her book, The Ogallala Road, A Story of Love, Family, and the Fight to Keep the Great Plains from Running Dry. Here is Al in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for taking my call. My understanding is that the Ogallala spans several states from the north to the south. And I have two questions. One, is there any relation between the Dust Bowl and the drying of the Ogallala at one point, I guess in the 30s? And the second, with regard to, aren't there many other places where it gets recharged? And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thank you, Al.
Well, there wasn't a relationship between the Ogallala Aquifer drying and the Dust Bowl because we had not begun to pump the aquifer at that point in time. We were dryland farmers. And in the next couple of decades, there evolved some farming practices that would prevent another Dust Bowl from happening. As far as the current use of the Ogallala Aquifer, the place is drying out, certainly, the surface in those areas where you have creek beds. But the draining of the aquifer itself is not going to cause another Dust Bowl. I didn't catch the second question.
And I don't remember it either. My apologies,
okay,
to Al. But so back to the Ogallala itself. You mentioned a policy called zero depletion. What's that?
There was a groundwater management district director in our area back then who was really a go-getter. That was back in the 1980s, and he devised a plan called zero depletion, which would have required farmers to take no more water out of the aquifer than went back into it. And for a while, that got national attention, and it looked like it was going to happen, but the people who lived in that area and who owned land had the right to vote on it, and they voted it down.
So it got some consideration, but not enough to actually get
adopted.
You mentioned places like Goodland, Colorado, which, in your words, dying despite irrigation and to some extent because of it. This is a real interesting double-edged sword for the folks who live above the Ogallala.
Yes, it's actually Goodland, Kansas, and the reason it's dying, and it's like many of those plains towns, the storefronts are all emptying out, and they look, some of them, like ghost towns at this point. And the reason that's happening is because in order to develop irrigation, you needed to have a lot of capital, and so you built these big farms and the people who didn't have the money to buy into irrigation, a lot of them sold to their neighbors and left. And another reason it's happening is because we have all this big machinery now. So where it used to take 6 hired men on a farm, it now took, on our farm, for instance, it only took 1 man, and sometimes his wife would help him. We had these big tractors, and they could get done in a day what it used to take 6 men to get done in a week.
Wow.
So the area is just emptying out.
All right, much more to talk about with Julene Baer about the Ogallala Aquifer and her life above it. The Ogallala Road is her her memoir, now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we return. Back to the Jefferson Exchange with Julene Baer, the Ogallala Aquifer, and you in a minute 30. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Julene Baer. She's a writer with a couple of books to her credit, the latest one being her memoir, The Ogallala Road, a story of love, family, and the fight to keep the Great Plains from running dry. The Ogallala references to the Ogallala Aquifer that underlies the Great Plains. Julene is from Kansas and returned there, and that's from whence come many of the memories from this book. It is now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 anywhere in the listening area, or by phone, by email rather, jx@jeffnet.org. You were talking about the changes in the ways that farms are managed just before the break, about how a farmer and his wife could do in a day what six men used to take a week to do. But other changes in the farming industry in general, I was surprised at something you pulled up here from Ezra Taft Benson, who had been Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, who basically challenged American farmers to change the scale in which they were doing things. What did he say?
Get big or get out.
Really?
Yes. The farm program made grain prices quite low, and because America had what many refer to as a cheap food policy. So you grow more corn or more wheat in order to turn a profit. Corn is actually the problem, as I see it, with the aquifer, because the federal government has some policies that are driving the planting of so much corn. And one of those is just crop insurance for corn, whether you grow it dry land or irrigated. And the other is the ethanol mandate, which requires that more and more ethanol be added to the nation's fuel supply each year. Most of that ethanol comes from corn. So prices just shot up when that went through in 2007, and an immense amount of acreage went into corn. We had 98 million acres in the country in 2013, and that was more than in the 1930s.
Wow, that's a lot of corn. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in the 1930s, people were still using, I think, animals for some of their farm work, which required some corn for feed.
Right. The other high was back in I think it was 1930. There was something close to that back then. So it had been the most since then that had been planted. Something like 23 or almost 24 million acres went out of grasslands and marshlands in order to grow corn, or wheat would move onto those lands and they would plant corn on their wheat land. At any rate, there's been an immense change in the amount of corn grown in the country.
Julene, does corn consume a lot more water than wheat does?
Yes. Yeah. Wheat, you know, you don't need any water to grow wheat. Period. You can grow it on what falls from the sky. And as I said earlier, in a drought year, you might need a couple of inches of irrigation water. But in a regular average year in Kansas, it takes 14 inches of irrigation water to grow a corn crop.
Wow, that's still amazing to me. There's a really interesting moment with your family at Thanksgiving in the book. And it seems like the subject of water use is broached very carefully there. But I mean, is there a feeling, a consistent feeling among family members about water use on the Ogallala?
Well, among my family, actually, most farmers at this point they know that it's a major problem, and they know something needs to be done. They've seen their neighbors run out of water. Their wells aren't pumping at the rates that they used to. They know that prediction in Kansas, for instance, that in 50 years, 70% of the water will be gone. So as a consequence, in Kansas, we have what is called a new water vision. and team members from different regions have been going out and taking input from farmers about what should be done. But the problem with this new Kansas Water Vision, however, is that it defers, as Kansas policy and most state policies throughout the Ogallala region, it defers to what they call local control, meaning the farmers are going to have to decide if they want to save, quote, their water. But it's not their water. It really belongs to the state.
That's a
Go ahead.
That's a tricky concept to get across, though. I mean, because it gets into the usual realm, I think, of like, well, this is my land. I can do what I want to with what's under my land. But there's an acknowledgement by other people that we're talking about a much broader area and many more people affected than just you and your land.
Right. And the Kansas water law makes it very clear that the water doesn't belong to the farmers. They're just given permits, and that those allocations can be reduced at the state's will. Unfortunately, the state won't take the measures it needs to take. I mean, we're seeing similar things going on in California now, where now there's a new groundwater law, but it's going to be 30 years before those different regions are required to reach sustainability. They're being given that much time to do that, and if they don't do that, supposedly the state is going to step in and impose sustainability, meaning they can't take out any more than goes back in each year. But as to whether or not that will actually happen, who knows? And then 30 years is a long time, and we're using...
Whoops, we seem to have lost Julene Bear. We're going to effort to get her back on the phone right now, so... It takes a couple of minutes of button pushing here to get her back on the line, but we will do that. Her novel, or not a novel, her memoir is called The Ogallala Road, a story of love, family, and the fight to keep the Great Plains from running dry. It is Julene Bear's second book, and this memoir is now out in paperback. Julene Bear, if you heard the beginning of the show or didn't hear it, she graduated from the Iowa Writers' Workshop and the Iowa Nonfiction Writing Program. Her essays have appeared in several anthologies, in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune. So Julene is back on the line with us now. Welcome back.
Yeah, I don't know where I got cut off. So
we have fun with the phones here sometimes, but
yes.
Good to have you here. So there are other states besides Kansas, obviously. Kansas has this water vision idea, but it defers to local control. What about the other states on the Ogallala Aquifer, like Nebraska?
Well, Nebraska regulates its water better than Kansas does, actually. They've imposed some more stringent controls on their farmers than we have in Kansas. And on the other hand, in some areas of Nebraska, they don't really need as much control because water percolates down into the aquifer much faster in the sand hills, so they have an excess of water. They really don't need that much control in certain areas of Nebraska. Texas is notorious for a rule they call the right to capture, meaning if a farmer lives over the aquifer, he can just drill a well and take all the water he wants, which surprisingly is also what has been traditionally happening in California as well. You know, California government doesn't even know where all the wells are.
Oh, yeah, I'm aware of the fact, since we cover California, that it hasn't even had a groundwater law until just very recently.
Right,
And so just no tracking, really, of what the resources are there at all. Because everything was about storage and irrigation and reservoirs and all that sort of stuff, surface water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
How far, I mean, had you known much about I mean, you talked about your what it sounds like a baptism in a mountain lake and deciding that you wanted to live closer to nature. But at the time you returned to Kansas in the events that you write about in the beginning of the Ogallala Road, were you that educated on the whole on water policy and the physics of water? As you are
not
now.
At all. Mm-hmm. Not at all. All I knew is that I had this bodily relationship with it, that I loved swimming in those lakes. And so when I opened those gates, those pipe gates on the flood irrigation fields and saw that water flowing out, it felt like I was cutting one of my own arteries. So it sort of started me down this track of learning more. And I thought, eventually I have to write about this. And I finally decided the time had come.
You write in the Ogallala Road of the future of the bear farm being a forbidden topic. Why?
Well, my father always said, hang on to your land. And like most farmer fathers, he told us to do that, and we always assumed we would. We never could imagine that we would sell the land, and we had seen other people make that mistake, and we didn't feel like we would ever make that mistake. But it became much more difficult. By the time my father had died, when the book opens, it's 10 years later, and neither my brother nor I live near there. So it would be very difficult to manage it from a distance, to continue managing it from that distance. And then along came Ward, who forms the narrative, a lot of the narrative of this book, because here was my opportunity to perhaps live back there and do right by the aquifer.
And you write about Ward's Ranch in the Smoky Valley, and it was a special place to you. The Smoky River itself, and you've already told us about your own experiences with the way the water had changed from your childhood. How had that river changed compared with earlier in Ward's lifetime?
Well, it had gone down to barely a trickle, and originally it was wide enough and copious enough to support the westering pioneers. They traveled along the Smoky Hill Road on their way to the Denver gold fields. But now there wasn't that much water in it. I was just out there last week again and saw that Smoky Gardens, which was this picnic area and a little lake on the Smoky Hill River, is now bone dry. And that wasn't true the last time I was there, which was probably about 7 years ago.
Is it bone dry year round, or does it have some times when there's water there?
I haven't been there in the fall or winter, so I can't say for sure, but I would imagine it is.
Julene, was there always a someday I'll be back sort of thought in the back of your mind, even when you might not have admitted to yourself about Kansas?
No. No. When I left at 18, I left that place behind me. I was sure that I was through with that, and I was going to go on and have a much more exciting life. And even when I lived in the desert, I loved living in the Mojave Desert much more than I had loved living in Kansas, because it was very rugged and it was very wild and it was still wilderness. It couldn't be farmed. It was too rugged to farm. And that's why the Smoky Valley, when I met Ward and did wind up thinking about going back to Kansas, that's why the Smoky Valley appealed to me so much, is it couldn't be farmed. Therefore, it was in the original grass, which is just really beautiful.
Is there any program in consideration in Kansas in particular that is buying up farmland or considers moving in that direction to just let it lay fallow so it's not actually requiring the water out of the Ogallala Aquifer?
No, I don't know of any program like that, although the federal government is offering some money, but not enough for farmers to retire their water rights, which would mean they would revert to dryland farming or grazing. There is a nature conservancy ranch in the Smoky Valley, so only those most beautiful places do people tend to come in and buy them up in order to preserve them.
I hadn't even asked about the balance between, we've been talking in general terms about family farms, but I have to believe that there's a fair amount of large corporate farms there as well, or something along those lines.
Yes, and it's strange how those corporate farms evolve. I know a lot of them are people from New York or wherever buying land because it's a good investment. That certainly does happen. And then they rent that land to operators. But the way most of those corporations evolve is it's a family like ours that just kept, and ours didn't get mega large, but there are family farms there that just over the years acquired more and more of their neighbor's land, and they became corporations. And all the people on the board are people who have a history there and roots there, but most of them don't live there any longer.
You've done some evangelizing, I understand, across Kansas and around the aquifer itself, just to talk about the reality of the issues there. Who are you generally speaking to, and what's been the response?
Well, it started out I was talking in eastern Kansas, where all the laws are made and where most of the population lives and where it rains more. And it was easier to talk to people in eastern Kansas. There's more people who consider themselves environmentalists there. But I've been making it my mission to get further and further west in Kansas. And the reason I was down there this last week is I was talking in the county just north of our county, in a town where my father grew up, actually. And it was really, it was great to talk to those people, because not only do they realize there's a problem, but they're not getting the opportunities that they need to have public discussions about it. So it was very rewarding to be able to be part of that conversation and maybe stimulate it a little bit.
You make a brief reference to politics in Kansas. It's, and there are whole books about this, What's the Matter with Kansas, for example.
Yeah.
How different does it seem to you as somebody who's from there from when you were growing up?
Well, it did change over the years. I considered Kansas more of a mainstream type of state. It probably always was Republican, but it was, I mean, even Republicans back then were more mainstream. Richard Nixon passed the, he set up the Environmental Protection Agency by administrative decree. And so things have changed a lot. Politics has gotten a lot more radical and divisive. And but I find that when I go there and talk to actual people, nobody's thinking in those black and white ways. They're realizing that it's a complicated problem, and they want to make the changes necessary to solve it. They just don't know how.
We've talked a lot about the aquifer itself, but there is much more to the book, and it's a real pleasure to read. The Ogallala Road, A Story of Love, Family, and the Fight to Keep the Great Plains from Running Dry. Julene Bear, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care.